Can you hear me? It has been a glorious time to be alive, and doing research in theoretical physics. Our picture of the universe has changed a great deal in the last 50 years, and I'm happy if I have made a small contribution. The fact that we humans, who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come this close to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe is a great triumph. I want to share my excitement and enthusiasm about this quest. So remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up. Thank you for listening.
That was, of course, the voice of Stephen Hawking, taken from a clip released by the University of Cambridge to mark his death on the 14th of March. I'm Zia Morali, and shortly you'll be listening to the FQXI podcast, which Brendan Foster and I recorded before the news of Hawking's death. So before playing that in, we wanted to say a few words about what this loss means to FQXI. There have been so many lovely and poetic tributes from around the world commemorating not just Hawking's impact on science, but also how he inspired people with his courage in the face of great physical adversity and through his campaigning for social justice. He was a truly global icon. But to many FQXI members, Hawking wasn't just a celebrity. He was a colleague, a mentor, and a friend. Some of our members collaborated with him in his early research years, working with him on some of his groundbreaking ideas, and remained lifelong friends with Hawking and his family. You can read his former student and colleague Don Page's memories on the FQXI blog. Others trained with Hawking in his later years and consider him a mentor. Still more were guided into theoretical physics by reading his book, A Brief History of Time. 4 out of 5 of us working at FQXI, in fact, are trained in theoretical cosmology, and the trajectories of our lives may have played out very differently were it not for the influence of Stephen Hawking in our early lives. In a similar vein, I would also like to mention the sad loss of another towering figure in theoretical physics, Joe Polchinski, who passed away this year in February, and was a colleague and a great friend of many at FQXI. So very many of the research projects at the very cutting edge of foundational physics, many that you have heard about on this podcast in the past, some you'll hear about today, and many that you will doubtless hear about in the future, were seeded by the work of these physicists. Between them, they revolutionised our understanding of black holes, the beginning of the universe, string theory, and maybe even the existence of a multiverse. And they raised many profound new puzzles that physicists are grappling with today. Their legacies will remain for decades, and they will be missed. Now, here's the FQXI podcast. You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, light from the universe's first stars might illuminate dark matter, with cosmologist Renan Barkana.
But they actually contacted me with a big puzzle because the strength of the absorption was completely outside the full range of theoretical predictions. So it seemed basically an impossibly strong signal.
Our place in the multiverse. Cosmologist Eugene Lim calculates what observers in different universes might see.
So let's suppose that we live in a universe without electromagnetism. Can this object, quote-unquote, observer that we just postulated, can it still exist? So by doing this kind of thought experiment, we can start to understand what really is the minimum number of physical laws we need to constitute an observer that can self-sense the surroundings.
And setting up a science hostel in Maui with physicist Garrett Lisi.
And basically, when you have a nice place in Maui and you say, hey, come stay for free, enjoy the place, that's guaranteed to be successful. There's no way this can fail.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Welcome to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. We've been away for a couple of months while some of us have been working and some have been holidaying in Maui.
Yes, that was me. But that was work too, as you will hear later in the podcast. But in the meantime, much has been happening in the world of physics. First up, astronomers have used the EDGES telescope in Western Australia to detect light from the cosmic dawn. That is, light from the very first stars to have formed in the universe just 180 million years after the Big Bang. The team was led by Judd Bowman, an astronomer at Arizona State University in Tempe.
Yes, it's a really exciting result that was reported in Nature in February, which confirms what astronomers thought about when the first stars appeared. But at the same time, the discovery has opened up a new mystery about what was going on in the early universe, because the signal they found was more than double the strength that the astronomers expected, and they really aren't sure why. Earlier, I spoke with Renan Bakana, a cosmologist at Tel Aviv University in Israel, who published a companion piece in the same issue of Nature, trying to solve the puzzle of the strangely strong signal. His solution, if correct, could tell us some new things about dark matter. But before getting to that, Bakana began by telling me how the team of astronomers set about finding signs of this light from the first stars, which is so hard to see directly from ground-based telescopes.
So when we look in the universe, the farther away we look, the farther back in time we see, just because it takes the light so long to get to us. If you want to explore the early universe, early times, you have to look so far away that stars and even galaxies, which we expect to have been fairly small at these early times, they become very, very hard to detect. So if you're talking about very early times when stars first began to form in the universe, we don't really expect to be able to see anything from that time directly, with planned new telescopes. I work in a field where theorists like me have been predicting for 15 or 20 years that there should be an indirect way to learn when stars began to form in the universe and what their properties were, and that is through radio waves. Briefly, the idea is that the universe at that time was full of gas, mostly hydrogen gas, and theorists predicted that when the first stars formed, the radiation coming out of these stars affected the gas in a way that caused it to produce some signal in radio waves. That's why people have been, for about a decade, various collaborations of radio astronomers have been building radio telescopes and detectors to try to detect this signal, this early cosmic radio signal that should indicate to us the formation of the first stars.
And so when you talk about this characteristic signal, we're talking here about looking at the cosmic microwave background, is that right? The relic radiation from the Big Bang. And we're looking at sort of a specific kind of dip in that radiation. Is that the idea?
Yes, exactly. So the cosmic microwave background is actually a remnant of a much earlier time, before there were any stars, and the universe was very hot and full of light. And that light today we see as microwave and radio waves. As I said, when the stars form, they turn on a feature in the gas, in the hydrogen gas, that should absorb the radio waves that fill the universe. So it's basically, it should block the cosmic microwave background at certain wavelengths. And this is the absorption that we're talking about, which was observed now for the first time in this new EDGES experiment.
Right, okay. So this EDGES experiment, as you say, so that's EDGES for the experiment to detect the global epoch reionization signature. So this is a radio telescope out in Western Australia. And as you say, they've seen this dip at 21 centimeters. And so, you know, this sounds very exciting. This sounds like, you know, light from the first stars. How did you first find out about this result, and how exciting was it to you to hear about it?
I've been collaborating with observers, including with the EDGES experiment, and they contacted me because they think that for the first time they see what seems like a signal, which they had been checking for months to make sure it was correct, and it seemed to be indeed there on the sky. The signal was as expected in terms of at what time the stars formed, and this we can recognize based on the wavelengths of the radio waves, because as the universe expands, the wavelengths of these radio waves expand with it as well. So that is a sign that tells us from how early in the universe is this signal coming. So all of that was fine. It was as expected. But they actually contacted me with a big puzzle, because the strength of the absorption was completely outside the full range of theoretical predictions. So it seemed basically an impossibly strong signal. And they asked me if I had any kind of explanation for that.
Well, okay, so both exciting and surprising. So they did find the characteristic dip where they expected to, you know, and they measured a drop in radiation. It was about like a 0.1% drop in radiation, I think. But it was, you know, twice what they expected, or twice what theoreticians had been predicting. So, you know, so they came to you and said, you know, what's going on here? So, you know, what did you think?
That's right. I mean, so this is an interesting interaction between theory and experiment, right? Whether you believe each of them depends on their interaction. So you would be more skeptical of the observation as well until you can come up with at least some theoretical explanation. And really, they had no idea what that could be. I mean, it was clearly indicating that they're seeing something beyond just the first star, beyond what was the original goal of this observation. So then I thought about it, and it seemed that the way to explain this is that the gas, the cosmic gas at that time, was colder than the coldest that we think it could have been, because it turned out that the colder the gas is, the stronger it absorbs these radio waves. But then the next question, so the next logical step was, how can it be so cold? What could possibly cause it to be cold? So here, the point is that it's very easy to heat things up. If you think like you're a heater in your room, there's no such thing that actually cools your room. To cool your room, the way an air conditioner works, it doesn't actually absolutely cool the room. It actually has to throw the heat outside of the room. So that's a big fundamental physical difference between heating and cooling. So to cool down the gas, you actually need it to interact with something else, which takes its heat away. And for that to happen naturally, something else has to be even colder than the gas.
Right, I see.
We're talking about this early time in the universe when stars are only beginning to form. So that actually the gas throughout the universe is extremely cold at that time. It's the coldest that it will ever be. Because earlier, the universe began very dense and hot. Everything was very hot. Over time, it expanded and cooled down. But and later, once stars begin to form, their radiation, as I mentioned, heats up the gas. So the gas today is again very hot. So there's this little period, which is exactly this cosmic dawn era, before there are too many stars, when the gas is the coldest it will ever be. So it's very hard to imagine what can be even colder and cool down the gas. And then it hit me that basically the only candidate that we know of in terms of a component of the universe that can be even colder is the dark matter.
Dark matter, you know, this is a substance that astronomers believe we have, again, sort of indirect evidence for.
Exactly.
It makes up most of the matter in the universe, but it's sort of invisible to see using normal telescopes. It's something we kind of infer its existence because it has a kind of gravitational effect on visible matter. At least that's what we kind of think, that the only way it really interacts is through gravity.
Right. But because through gravity, we know that there's a lot of missing mass out there. Gravity is simply too strong in our galaxy and other galaxies, is too strong to be explained by the mass that we know, that we can see from stars and gas. So it's actually most of the mass in the universe. And so that's why it's considered a very big puzzle and mystery, not only in astronomy, but in physics generally. What is dark matter? What is this main component of mass in the universe? So this potential idea was very, very exciting, and I began to think about it, and I made a detailed model, detailed calculation, and it seemed to work very well to explain this very deep absorption signal of the radio waves through this combination that on the one hand you have the dark matter, which is cooling down the ordinary matter, and on the other hand you have the signal that we expected, which is that the first stars, their radiation turns on the ability of the gas to absorb. So when you combine the dark matter and the first stars, you can get the signal that was absorbed, observed.
As you say, we don't know what dark matter really is. So in your model, are you thinking of the most prevalent theory of dark matter that's out there? Or are you thinking of dark matter that perhaps has different properties or can interact with visible matter in a different way?
Right. So that's quite an interesting question. So for this cooling to occur, the dark matter would have to interact with ordinary matter in some way, with some force that might be analogous to an electric force, but not exactly the regular electric force that we know, but something similar, something that would be in addition to the gravitational interaction. So, you know, if this is verified by additional observation, then this is a first additional clue about what the dark matter is made of. But one nice conclusion which came out doesn't depend at all on the details of these interactions. And that is that actually that the leading idea for dark matter cannot be correct, because the leading idea for dark matter predicts that dark matter should consist of heavy, fairly heavy particles. However, if the dark matter were heavy, it turns out that even if it interacted with the ordinary matter, it would not be able to cool it down. So the dark matter actually has to be made up of light particles for this cooling to explain the radio signal.
And so, you know, this is this is tremendously exciting. As you say, you're kind of thinking about a different type of dark matter and maybe giving us some clues for how to look for this. Are there any experiments that are currently looking for this specific type of dark matter or these kinds of potential interactions? Or is this something where people could go away and now, you know, on the basis of this, perhaps try and see if they can develop an experiment that could test this idea?
Right. So there actually are a number of very big experiments, very large efforts to detect dark matter in labs. The hope is that a dark matter particle, if it goes through your lab, it might produce some kind of light signal if it interacts with this material in your lab. Now, the experiments to date that have been run have focused, again, on this leading idea for dark matter, which predicts heavy particles. So they are actually not sensitive to light particles. And despite the large efforts, no dark matter has been detected, and it's been getting frustrating. So even before this, people have been thinking about new types of approaches, going to new experiments that would be looking in new directions for lighter particles. So this new clue from astronomy suggests that we should go in different direction than where people have been looking thus far.
And, you know, talking about this theme of other experiments, people are still quite cautious, you know, including, you know, the authors and the scientists on the Edges experiment to say, you know, as you mentioned yourself, when they first saw this surprising result, they took a lot of time to check it and recheck it because it sort of, you know, it had these very interesting and exciting implications. And there are other experiments out there, and we're hoping that they will confirm this result. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the other experiments that maybe will be looking to see if they see the same result.
There are two levels of confirmation here. One would be to just confirm the signal itself in the radio wave, that it's really this surprising signal is correct and it's on the sky and coming from the early universe. And then the second confirmation would be this dark matter explanation. But as you mentioned, the good news is that this whole field of studying the early universe, cosmic dawn through radio waves, is only beginning. I mean, this is the first successful measurement in this field, but there are indeed many efforts to measure this. And this first experiment, it provides relatively limited information because what it measures is the average intensity of radio waves on the sky. And there are going to be more experiments of this type that will try to verify the signal. But within hopefully a few years or slightly more, I mean, there are a number of much bigger efforts coming, and those will be made up of very large numbers, thousands of radio antennas that will be able to produce for us full images of the radio sky, which means the intensity of radio is coming from different directions on the sky. And for that, for example, the dark matter model makes a very specific prediction of the pattern of radio waves that is expected. So this would be a much clearer test and give us a lot more information and confidence. It will probably take a few years to happen, but now this result, this potential, you know, gold mine on dark matter is going to boost the whole field. So hopefully things will advance more quickly than we thought. I mean, I would just emphasize the big picture that it's again an example of where physicists have looked in a new regime at the time of the universe where we don't have any other observations. And the first time we measure something, it's a big surprise. So it's kind of nice that nature continues to surprise us, even though we think we know quite a bit of astronomy and physics.
Thank you to Renan Barkana for chatting with Zia. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, we're linking to news articles with more information about the discovery, and also to an interesting blog post by astronomer Aaron Parsons of University of California, Berkeley, who urges caution, noting that the observed signal might be an artifact of the way that the measuring instrument works, rather than a true measure of an astronomical effect.
Yes, and it's for these reasons and others like that that Parkana notes that astronomers will be eagerly waiting to see if other experiments can corroborate these findings. Independent experiments such as the Hydrogen Epoch of Reionization Array in development in South Africa, or LOFAR, the Low Frequency Array, in Europe.
That's the great thing about science. You can make a prediction and then see if different independent experiments observe the same thing.
Unless, that is, the observations are being carried out in other parallel universes, where you might not expect to see the same thing because the laws of physics might be different. Oh, and of course, it's kind of hard to compare your results in this universe with the results of your neighbors in parallel universes in the multiverse.
Especially since we don't know for sure whether a multiverse of other such parallel universes even exists. But some versions of inflation theory, a mainstream theory of cosmology that says that our early universe went through a period of rapid expansion, does suggest that other such neighboring universes are out there.
Yeah, the idea is that if the cosmos we see around us originated from one tiny patch of space that inflated to astronomical proportions, then, in the same way, many other tiny patches of space could also have inflated into their own cosmoses at different times. If true, this would create a plethora of neighboring universes in a large multiverse.
And each of these universes might have different physical laws. But while, by definition, we can't observe those parallel universes directly, cosmologist Eugene Lim of King's College London in the UK is trying to work out whether they could give rise to observers and what those observers might measure, as he explained to reporter Sophie Hebden.
Eugene Lim of King's College London and Richard Easter of the University of Auckland are working on questions relating to the multiverse and our place in it. They're asking, can any of the different universes predicted by string theory, each with their different fundamental constants of nature, give rise to observers, and what sort of observations could they make? Eugene started by explaining that one of their motivations is to try to understand theories of eternal inflation. Inflation was first proposed in 1980 by Alan Guth, to resolve some puzzling observations of the early universe that didn't fit with standard Big Bang theory. These puzzles include why the cosmic background radiation looks so uniform across space, and why the geometry of the universe is so flat. Inflation resolves the problems as a repulsive sort of energy, such that a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang, space-time itself exploded exponentially. In eternal inflation theories, inflation continues forever, with some regions of space forming distinct bubbles, called pocket universes, in the broader multiverse of space-time. I caught up with Eugene over Skype.
If you look at the theory of inflation and take what we know today about particle physics or quantum mechanics, and then logically drive it to the bitter end, you will find that for a certain kind of interpretation of our knowledge of physics today, it turns out that for certain types of models of inflation, you will have this thing called eternal inflation, which is that inflation never quite ends, but it just keeps inflating. So maybe we live in a parallel universe where inflation already ended, but there are other parts of the universe that are still inflating. So that gives us a problem. And it's sort of like the old probabilistic problem coming back to bite you, which is that, well, why do we live in this particular universe? If you just take all the different kind of many pocket universes or bubble universe that's inflating, why do we end up living in this particular universe?
To answer that question, Lim thinks string theory could help. String theory suggests that at a fundamental level, particles are made up from tiny threads of energy. Different particles in the standard model of particle physics, the different quarks and leptons, are different manifestations of vibrating strings. Some versions of the theory predict the existence of 10 to the power of 500 universes, each representing a different universe with different values for the fundamental constants, such as the cosmological constant or the gravitational constant.
It's a motivation for us to try to understand the eternal inflation. And the way it goes as follows. String theory, one of many versions of string theories, one of them predict that there are many, many different solutions to string theory. So each of these solutions to string theory would represent a different set of laws of nature. So if you like, different solutions to string theory would give you maybe a different value of the cosmological constant, or different value of the gravitational constant, or different value of the fine structure constant. So there are various versions, various different solutions would give you different numbers, if you like. So it's a way for you to generate many different kind of fundamental constants. If you combine this picture with eternal inflation, there exists some mechanism that allows you to scan all the possible solution of string theory. So if you like, if you have many, many solutions, but it could turn out that each of these different bubble universes that I was talking about, which are generated by eternal inflation, each of them would have a different laws of physics, given what string theory given you. So then this gives us a way, a possibility of understanding why we live in the universe we live today, if we can find a way to understand how the different universes associated with different string theory solutions is distributed.
One of the issues that Lim and Issa are interested in is working out how much information there is in this universe to help understand the rest of the multiverse.
So what is the maximum information that we can actually get from making the observation that we see today? Obviously, we live in this bubble universe, and again, the naive way of understanding it, they say, oh, everything in this universe, we can eventually wait long enough and then collect all the information of this universe. But we know that that is not quite true. For example, we know that since there is the universe is accelerating now, we're beginning to lose information from the rest of the universe, because the presence of a current cosmological constant would start to dominate, and then just like inflation, information will get pushed out of our horizon. So then again, we have to ask ourselves, well, can we already collect all the information in this universe? Is it so? This is why the title of the one part of the title of our proposal is a maximum observation. What is the maximum amount of information we can collect from this universe?
Lim and Issa are studying the cosmic microwave background radiation, the relic radiation from the Big Bang, or CMB.
So the other constraint on the amount of information that we can collect from this universe is the notion of quantum decoherence. So we know that, for example, the initial conditions for the cosmic microwave background, for example, is quantum mechanical. So we know that they come from quantum fluctuations, so they begin their life as quantum fluctuations. But we know from looking at the CMB today that they are completely classical today. You point your telescope at one part of the CMB, they will look the same today, they'll look the same tomorrow, they'll look the same the day after. So they no longer, quote-unquote, quantum wave function. They are just classical states that you already have decohered. So now the question is that, well, how much of this, the initial quantum information that the universe begins with is lost, right? So that again is a measure of how much information we can collect from the universe today. That gives us, if you like, some structure for us to understand what is the fundamental physics of this universe. So the second part of our proposal is minimal observers. So the broad question is that what constitutes an observer? And the way that we want to approach this question is to start thinking about, okay, well, let's just suppose there is some measure of what level of complexity a set of atoms or molecules have to combine together to make a coherent object that can sense its surroundings. Of course, that's a very difficult question on its own, but let's suppose that we have that. Then the question that we can ask is that, well, if start taking away all the physical laws, so let's suppose that we live in a universe without electromagnetism. Can this object, quote-unquote, observer that we just postulated, can it still exist? And then we can start thinking of, like, say, oh, let's now take away gravity. So can this observer still exist? So by doing this kind of thought experiment, we can start to understand what really is minimum number of physical laws we need to constitute an observer that can self-sense its surroundings.
So how do you work out whether, say, an organism can exist without gravity or without Well, obviously without gravity is possible, I suppose.
Well, maybe not quite, right? Because, I mean, naively, we don't quite feel gravity that strongly. Astronauts can definitely go in space and be free-falling and still be alive.
Yeah.
But get to become an astronaut, you need stuff to collapse and form galaxies and stars and planets.
Yeah.
So that is not clear that without gravity we would have existed. So it's not clear to us, right? So this is the kind of thought that we want to pursue, right? So let's start thinking of, you know, we have all these physical laws that we know. Can observers form without such a law? It would be really nice if we can come up with some idea about what is the minimal set of physical laws that we need to construct such an observer. Yeah, of course, this depends on what an observer is, but I think, again, by using that idea as a framework for us to explore the conditions for observing, I think we can learn a lot about what, you know, the universe is.
And so once you've talked about the minimal type of observer that you can get, how does that link in with the maximal observation?
I think there are parallel threads. The meeting point for both projects is the notion that you need some form of observers making observations to understand what the universe is. Well, given such an observer that exists, what is the maximum amount of information that this observer can collect? And then the second question, which is, what is the minimal structure you require to be able to construct such a thing, an observer? So I guess, would they meet somewhere? Well, I guess they meet in the place where we start, which is that, you know, we need observers making observations to understand the universe.
That was Eugene Lim chatting with Sophie Hebden. And you can learn more about his research project with cosmologist Richard Easter of the University of Auckland in New Zealand in an article by Sophie on the website www.fqxi.org/community.
Now, from discussing our place in the multiverse to finding a nice, relaxing place in our universe, in the Hawaiian Islands, in fact, to research physics.
This is where we get to your holiday in Maui, right?
It wasn't a holiday. Totally. I was on a partly serious business trip visiting physicist Garrett Lisi, who FQXI fans may remember for his theory of everything based on the mathematical object E8. Lisi, in addition to working on physics and surfing and knowing everything there is to know about the island of Maui, has set up the Pacific Sciences Institute in Maui as a site that physicists can visit to conduct research. You know what? I'll just let him tell you more about it.
We're at the Pacific Science Institute, which is a fancy name for a small ranch house on Maui with delusions of grandeur.
I'm on the Pacific island of Maui, part of the Hawaiian Islands. To call it pretty is to do a great injustice. The island is flanked by two volcanoes, one dormant, one alive. The sky behind them is blue, of course, but words like open, majestic, graceful come to mind. The water is a color blue, so deep and radiant, you just want to become that color.
Yeah, sky is pretty here. So is the ocean.
I am on Maui to visit physicist and FQXI member Garrett Lisi and his new venture, the Pacific Sciences Institute. The institute is a sort of rest stop or retreat center for 21st century mobile scientists.
Yeah, it's not hostile to science. It's a hostel for scientists. I spent the better part of a decade after getting my PhD wandering around working on physics and spending my time in friends' houses. So pretty much if I had a friend with a guest house or a guest room, I'd camp out there for a month or so and work on stuff, spend time with my friend. And it was a pretty good way to live, just sort of hopping from friend's house to friend's house while I was working on stuff. And as things got a little bit better financially, I was able to buy my own house and then set this place up and start giving back to the same community whose houses I had been staying at. One of the reasons I started it is because I spent so much of my time working on theoretical physics, which is very difficult and frustrating and often unsuccessful in what you're trying to do. And I wanted to have another project that was science related that was guaranteed to be successful. And basically, when you have a nice place in Maui and you say, hey, come stay for free, enjoy the place, that's guaranteed to be successful. There's no way this can fail.
Lisi launched the Institute with help from an FQXI mini grant It operates as a non-profit organization. Researchers are free to come for as long as they need at no cost to them. The Institute buildings sit on a gentle slope in the upland valley between Maui's volcanoes, one visible out the front window, the other from the back porch. The buildings consist of a modest single-story house with three small one-room cabins dispersed through the backyard. The cabins are color-coded like quarks, red, yellow, and blue. Down the hill, Lisi has a vegetable garden with free-roaming chickens. It is all, as they say, very Pinterest-worthy. The overall feeling is peaceful, inspiring, yet domestic enough that I feel inclined to actually get some work done.
There are many well-established science institutes, but they tend not to be residential, the same way that artists' retreats are or writers' retreats are, which I think is a really nice environment. If you're living and working at a place, it takes a lot of the stress out of it if it's designed well. And it's just a nice environment for getting work done, as well as for playing and enjoying the island and socializing with other geeks. I'm also a strong believer in undirected research. I think the good stuff only really gets done when people really want to do it, not when they're being told this is what they should be doing. So basically, I just make space available for people to come and work on whatever they want and spend some time here.
Other science institutes tend to have small sets of scholars in residence for 6 months or even a year at a time. Lisi's Science Hostel is designed for a higher volume of smaller stays.
Since we started 2 years ago, we've probably had about 200 people come through. And people stay anywhere from, a few hours just coming by to say hello and hang out for a little bit. The record, I think, is 4 months for someone staying here. That was a little long, but that was a pretty good friend of mine, so I put up with him for a while. We usually have people here for 3 weeks out of every month, and then I have a week where it's just me, because we have all the separate cabins for people to stay in, so people can have their private time when they want it, and then come into the main part of the house and cook and hang out in the living room or work on their laptops or, semi-geek socialize.
Lisi is a physicist, but the Institute is open to all scientists. For Lisi, it's a way for him to stay connected to science despite his out-of-the-way location. He also stresses his point that it is a way of giving back to the science community, a way of doing his part as a science citizen.
I really think this is a wonderful way to support work in the sciences. It would be really nice just to have scientists respected a little bit more, treated a little bit better at all levels, not just at the highest levels. If some scientist is dedicating their life to advancing their field and they tend not to be compensated for it very well, okay, that's you're really giving your life over to doing this. And the ultimate benefit is to mankind as a whole. So this is really what the Pacific Science Institute is about. It's about making life better for scientists. It's about giving a nice place for people to come and stay and spend some time just because of the work they're doing and who they are. You're speechless, Brendan.
Well, I'm just looking at this. I'm just looking off into the distance.
That was Garrett Lisi, whose science hostel left Brendan lost for words there. Okay, Brendan, what's your verdict on the location? Could physics and science in general benefit from more places like this?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the location is great. Both.
You're speechless again.
Yeah. Et cetera, et cetera. The location is great. The idea actually makes a lot of sense when you're there. And in the modern world, it's like a writer's retreat where you get to get away from things and focus on what you're doing, but with enough infrastructure that you could do it. And I could see that in starting these up in lots of other locations also gives you the chance to get some of these physicists who don't always get to some out-of-the-way locations to go there and, give a talk or something like that and interact with whoever else is there.
So you just call up Garrett and ask him and then you can just go along?
You could just email the Pacific Sciences Institute and as long as you can prove somehow that you're a scientist and you're working on a legitimate project, even a theoretical one, then yeah, if he's got space, you can go and he'll take care of you.
Even a theoretical one. Okay, well, sounds intriguing.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about Lisi, his hostel, and his research into E8 theory, You can, through links on our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
That brings us to the end of the podcast. As always, you can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org and on Twitter @fqxi.
Thank you again to Renan Barkana, Eugene Lim, Sophie Hebden, and Garrett Lisi.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
I'm off to interact with some dark matter.
And I'm just going to go back to Maui.